Good morning and welcome to the roundtable panel and welcome to our discussion on the day after Election Day 2016. We're broadcasting live from the Linda Norris Auditorium in downtown Albany before an audience of some 200 people. And look, we've all been up for a long, long time, so if we start to nod off, you'll know why. But we're all here together, and we couldn't be more thrilled. I'm going to introduce the panel in just a second. Real quick, though, just so everyone at home knows, we'll not be taking emails today. So if you want to be, if you want to send them, save those for tomorrow, because we're going to be taking questions from the audience today. And that's how we're going to do that. So save your cards and letters, and we'll certainly get to those tomorrow when we're all back in the studio. In the meantime, let me welcome our panel this morning. First and foremost, WAMC's very own, my partner last night for all of the election coverage, who I'm sure is very tired, Dr. Alan Shartok. Good morning, Alan. Thank you.
Nobody's better at this than you are, Joe, so thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Associate editor of the Times Union newspaper, Mike Spain, joins us. Good morning, Mike.
Mike.
Director of the journalism program at the University at Albany, Rosemary Armeo, is with us.
Rosemary.
Political consultant Libby Post is here.
Libby.
Communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois is here. Times Union columnist Chris Churchill joins us. And author and activist and the woman who's sitting right behind me, so we can just hold hands for the whole, grip tight through the whole morning, Barbara Smith is with us. All right, so we're with you for 2 hours here. We're going to have a two-hour panel this morning, and as I mentioned, we're going to be going into the audience. One quick programming note, we have heard that Hillary Clinton is expected to give her concession speech around 9:30 this morning. We'll be taking that live. The audience here will, of course, be able to hear it, and you at home will be able to hear it. So we're going to be talking up until that point. We'll go to that, and then we'll come back and continue our conversation. So, just so you know. All right, Alan, let's start with you.
Okay.
What the hell happened?
Well, I...
I'll say it for you.
Alan was right.
Alan
in
was
unison,
right.
Everyone. Alan was right.
That's good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now we're only going to have to do that like three or four more times. But go ahead.
Now, I have to tell you, Rosella's been after me to leave the country. I've been calling, Aer Lingus all morning long, and the phones are busy. So, see, that's a joke. The phones are busy. So, because I don't think
everyone's leaving on a jet plane. Yeah.
Now, I am getting a fair amount of mail, Joe and panelists, from people who took me very seriously and said, You're not gonna leave, are you? We need you now. We need the program now. You can't leave, can you? Well, no, I'm not leaving. And this is a time, in my opinion, when everybody who is here has to sort of hold hands, not necessarily sing Kumbaya, but in fact understand that this is an election which split America down the middle. And the analysis is that the Trump way of approaching things was to go after the educated, quote, elite in this country, which he says is running things. And I presume many of the people sitting in this room and listening to this radio program right now are in that elite because you went to college, because you think about things, because it's not that you're better than anybody else, it's that you really have... You really have brains and you use them. And I think this may be a dangerous time for a lot of people. I'm very concerned that many of the things that we've been making some real progress on in this country, racial diversity, many people have said that there was one analyst who said, he took a gamble. He said, this might be the last election in which a white coalition, white male coalition, could be put together and win. Because we do know that people are people of color, Hispanics, and others are coming into their own politically in this country. And this may have been the last time, or we took a fork in the road, in my opinion, that is kind of dangerous. Anyway, that's enough for me, Joe. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Alan. Let's go to Libby Post.
Well, I'm dumbfounded, I think, just like everybody else is. But I wrote on Facebook this morning, and if I start to cry, folks, it just reinforces the fact that I'm not as hard as everybody gives me credit for. But that we can't, we just have to keep going, and we can't succumb to fear. He won on fear, and you know, it's love, hate, fear, and hope. That's how the world works. And he really did a job on fear and hate, and we cannot succumb to that, and we have to keep working. We have to keep being voices of reason, despite how difficult it might feel or actually might be. But this is our reality for possibly the next 4 years, but we can also shape our own realities. We're not moving to Canada. We're not leaving. We are going to stay here. Right, Lynn, we're not leaving. We're going to stay here and
with the wife, Libby.
Right, and continue to work and, you know, just make sure that, you know, this is our country. This is our state, our city, our towns, our villages. And we have to make sure that we are all here to raise our children and to make sure that the next generation can be. This is an election that's really good for, and Barbara will, I'm sure, back me up on this, straight white men and the women who love them. Because life, whilst you all progressives might be really taken aback by this, gay marriage is under attack, reproductive choice is under attack, people of color are under attack. All the things that we all hold dear are under the attack, and that's why we have to keep fighting the right fight, the good fight.
Thank you, Libby. Mike, we've covered a lot of elections together. What do you make of this?
Well, I just want to take a step back. You know, we all talked about how a decisive victory by Hillary Clinton would force the Republican Party to look at itself and maybe climb out of the ashes that it's in. You know, perhaps the Democratic Party needs to look at itself very closely right now and see what it missed here and see how it hasn't listened to places like the people in the industrial belt across the country and what went wrong here. I mean, there'll be a lot of analysis of this that will give us a lot more understanding of where the mistakes were made. It could have been it's a combination of a bunch of things. I'm very interested to hear what the millennials did, whether they came out and whether they participated, because without their participation, and it's their future, you know, the baby boomers, we're handing it off. It's their future, and it's their children that they're raising, and if they did not embrace Hillary Clinton, the Democratic Party needs to understand why and provide something. Now, you know, if they did do this,
can we take the keys away?
I think we're past that point.
Okay, all right, just checking.
But I, you know, one thing I'll say about Donald Trump, you know, he's not a man of his word, so a lot of the things that he's promised,
very true,
it may not actually happen. And you know, let's just be hopeful.
I woke up this morning and of course knew that we were going to speak, and I of course love everyone on the stage more than words could express. But the one person I really wanted to hear from and hear her thoughts and wisdom was Barbara Smith. Barbara, has it sunk in yet? Have you figured this out?
No, I haven't figured it out, but I'm devastated, and I have two words about whether he will be true. Sorry. He will be true to his word, Mike Pence. Mike Pence is a right-wing ideologue. Mm-hmm. If anything happens, or even if nothing does happen to the individual who will remain nameless, if anything happens to him during this term, the replacement is somebody who is far more dangerous and far worse, because he's ideological, hard right wing, and he has experience in governing. So I wrote something. I usually don't read something that I wrote, but I have to get this out and get it out clearly. And I want to make this perfectly clear as of today. I am a third-class citizen. Of course, I was born a second-class citizen in the middle of the 20th century. And up to last night, despite the gains of the civil rights movement, I remained one, because I live in a country where unarmed black women, men, and children can be killed by the state without consequences. Now, I am a third-class citizen, as are many others: Muslim Americans, Latinos and Latinas, LGBT Americans, women, people with disabilities, the list goes on. So you will not probably see me smile at all today, because for some of us, our lives have changed as of last night, because we are the target of all the vitriol, hatred, bigotry, and threat that got this person into the White House.
I'm sorry you have to follow that, but go ahead, Rosemary.
I wish those freaking Cubs had lost. I blame
them. I think you're on to something.
Now, wait. Don't get radical on us.
I blame them. I blame James Comey. I'm never reading Maureen Dowd again. She helped it. I'm extremely upset. Everything said before, I echo. However, Jeb Bush sent a message to Donald Trump, and he said, congratulations. And he acknowledged that Trump had done something remarkable, something that none of us in this room thought he could do, predicted he would not. And so if Jeb Bush can eat crow, if Hillary Clinton will be doing that in an hour or so, then I can too. And so the people have spoken, and it is time to live with that decision and to find hope in some things. I put a note on Facebook today saying, help me find some things to take hope of. And one of them, I realize, is just what we're doing right now. We are proving that the system is not rigged. We're not marching in the streets. We're sad, we're crying, but we are not taking up arms. That's something I'm not sure that the other side might have done. There are other things. Mike pointed out that Trump has had many positions on many things, so we don't know exactly what he's going to do. He was a Democrat not that long ago. He has ideas about the gay community and, I can't say anything good about women, but maybe some other things. And we may see a more moderate person than his speech, end of gridlock. We now have a solid red White House, House, and Senate, and the Supreme Court will, of course, be lost soon. So things will be done. I dread to think what they might be, but gridlock is over. For the first time since I know of, and maybe in modern times, the voiceless, the working class people of this country who hate us, and I'm among them, the educated elite, kind of proud to be there. I don't know what's wrong with being establishment or elite, but for the first time, the working class people who so hate us now are in charge. Let's see what they're going to do. It's nothing else. It will be a really, really interesting experiment. I think the Electoral College is doomed. I think it's fated for reform. We now have had the second president in, 16 years? Gore, and now Clinton, who won the popular vote and lost the Electoral College. That's not a good thing. I think both parties are going to undergo reform, and in that we may finally end up with something that many of the progressives have been calling for a long time, and in fact, the process that led to the results we're mourning today, a viable third party. The Republican Party is not the Republican Party that I grew up with, so we'll see what comes in the future. The press is, along with establishment and most of our other institutions, is in shatters, but we still have a lot of work to do, starting with what really happened in that election last night. Do we know? We don't. The demographics and the polls were all wrong. Is it because they were so terrible, or because something was altered by the Russians, by something else? We really do not know that yet. So investigative reporting is and needs to continue, and that's a good thing. And finally, for the first time in a really long time, if not in history, we're not going to see our president age. This is not a man who's going to go gray.
Wow. It's like so beautiful, and you ended with a hair joke. I love that. That's so great.
Chris Churchill.
Well, I think right now a lot of the focus is on Trump and is on the people who voted for him, and I certainly get that. I mean, it kind of feels in a way like George Wallace has won the presidency. But on the other hand, I think some of the blame has to go toward Hillary and the party that nominated her. I mean, it was pretty clear from the get-go that she was going to be a pretty deeply flawed candidate, and she was. I mean, I think she had so much baggage, and it was just weighing on her, and I don't think she could get over the finish line at the end because, you know, it was just slowing her down and slowing her down and slowing her down. And I think it's interesting that the thing, you know, we saw the Rust Belt states go red, and I think the thing that might have done that was NAFTA. And, you know, that's interesting because that's something that the Democrats did that hurt a lot of working people. And I think you could see that the warning signs that NAFTA was going to be an issue were there when Bernie was running. I mean, Hillary lost Michigan. You know, she struggled in these very states in the primary. And I think, hindsight being what it is, she should have gone back and spent a lot more time talking to those people because it was obvious that they were skeptical of her from the get-go.
Teresa, I'm going to hold you for a second. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to get your comments. And then we'll talk a little bit and go to a news break at the bottom of the hour, find out. We just found out, I had mentioned 9:30, we were expecting Hillary Clinton. We now find out that it's going to be 10:30. So just keep that in mind. So we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. Thank you very much, and welcome back. And we've been hearing from all of our panelists. We are coming to you live from the Linda Norris Auditorium in downtown Albany, and a special two-hour panel edition of the Roundtable. We've heard from everyone except for Teresa Bourgeois, and Teresa, you're up.
Well, I'm going to refrain from immediately responding to what Chris just said. We're going to hold that in abeyance for a little bit. But I think, as an overview, we live in a great country. It was great before. It's a very resilient country. It's a very diverse country. And we truly are stronger together. And I think that we really do need to understand what happened in terms of what the people were saying and how we can all listen to each other in a better way. And, you know, what we learn from this and how we move on. Now, fundamentally in democracy, it's very hard to win a third term. Change is hard. This country is trying to do a very difficult thing, which is, as we've been doing for a long time, which is bringing very diverse groups of people together and hold that together in a democracy. And the challenge for us now who are disappointed is how we respond to this and how we continue to have our voices heard in a way that's inclusive and building. So that's my broad, you know, what do we do now? And I was saying to people, I'm channeling my inner Ted Kennedy. I had the privilege of working for him. And I remember when the Democrats lost, there's been books, and I brought one, I read some of it last night, about what you do when you're in the minority and how you use that and how you learn from that and come together and be stronger. And so I think that's really the challenge now is how do we take this and move forward? And we lived through 68 and Nixon, and you know, we've gone through, you know, the early Bush years. There was a war, but we stood up to that. And it did damage, but we're a resilient country, and now's the time to get to work.
Teresa, doesn't that depend on what Trump does? I mean, it's one thing to sit here and say we can live this, we may have to, but does it depend on what Trump does? Like, I keep having visions of Chairman Mao and the Cultural Revolution.
Well, that's why I was
saying, in which people were being beaten in the streets, you know.
Right, that's why I say our democracy is strong. The government, we have to count on the government continuing to work and do its business, and it might do it in different ways than we would, but you know, we had with Bush, we had Katrina, that initial response because he really didn't understand how to run FEMA. But a lot of the fundamentals of the government will keep going. And then in a democracy, all of us have a right to continue to speak up. And so we have to keep working We have to work harder now. I think we really have to, and we have to understand the economic insecurity that these folks feel and felt, that all of us, because I think a lot of people share that across a diverse country, that sense of economic insecurity. And there is a serious economic divide, and I think that they voted last night.
So a couple of things. How many people of color do you think Trump will have in his cabinet and in the highest levels of our staff?
I'll have Ben Carson, probably.
Yeah, right. So, yeah. And we big yuck. Excuse me. Yeah, that's really funny. One of the things about most of the administrations going probably from the Kennedy era until now is that there have been increasing numbers of people of color in them, even in Republican administrations. What's the percentage of black people who voted for him? Less than five, around five, maybe, across the country. He has utter contempt for people of color. That's how he started his campaign. Right. Mexicans are rapists and murderers. What's that going to look like? I don't have the optimism that you do about how strong our system is, because I've never lived in the America that you've described. Well, so for me and for people like me, this is a break point.
We're gonna hold you there, and we are gonna take a break. We're gonna hear news at the bottom of the hour. Again, Hillary Clinton expected to speak in about an hour, 10:30, and to give a concession speech in New York City. We are coming to you live from the Linda Norris Auditorium. It's WAMC's roundtable panel. And again, hold your letters, because we're taking questions from the crowd, and we'll do that in just a moment. Stay tuned. We'll be back after this short break. Welcome back to our roundtable panel, our all-star panel that is at the Linda in downtown Albany, right across the street from our WAMC studios. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, Libby Post, Teresa Bourgeois, Barbara Smith, and Chris Churchill joining me on the stage. We have a live audience. We'll be going to them in a few minutes with some questions. I was really moved by what everyone had to say, and obviously we have a lot to discuss over the 90 minutes or so that we have left. One of the questions brought up of what is a Donald Trump cabinet going to look like? And so let us begin there, and Alan, take it.
Well, the first among equals in this cabinet is going to be Rudy Giuliani.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He is, and so we know what, you know, you watch Law and Order as much as I do, and there's always a reference, there's always a reference to Giuliani time. And we know what it is. It's going to be rough on people of color, very rough. They'll be driving while black and walking while black and stop and frisk and all that stuff that we thought we were getting over. Well, when the new president puts a couple of people on the Supreme Court, and one wonders whether the Democrats will do unto them what they've had done unto them, to them. But I'm assuming that they get to the Supreme Court. It's going to be everything is going to be all of that stuff is going to be back on the table, and I think Giuliani is going to be doing a big part of running this country, and we're going to have to really keep our eyes on that. Look, you know, when I was a kid, we did a lot of marching on Washington, and we went a lot. And I'm afraid that it's going to be necessary again.
Right.
People are going to have to.
Yeah. Rosemary?
Yeah, this is what kept me. I decided to go to bed last night when it became evident what was happening, and I closed my eyes, and an image of Sarah Palin, Energy Secretary, came to me.
What about Newt Gingrich, Secretary of State?
Well, I thought so.
And then there's even Kellyanne Conway as White House spokeswoman.
Oh. Chris Christie as
transition leader or whatever.
No, transportation.
Yeah, and, you know, we're laughing, and that's good because we have to do that. Someone in the audience has texted us the stages of grief. Very appropriate. I'm in the depression stage. You can tell. Black funeral, I'm still feeling that. And when I think through this clearly, it gets worse and worse. It isn't just the Supreme Court that's bad enough. but every federal judge that comes up, all those ones that have been left unapproved that Obama puts in, guess who gets to fill those right now? So the independent judiciary goes. And I cannot help but be reminded that this is the 78th anniversary of Kristallnacht.
There you go.
And we have been chastised by listeners for a long time for comparing the rise of Trump to the rise of Hitler, and yet I continue to see the comparisons. And yes, for all of us who are saying, oh yeah, we have all these protections, we have a press that speaks up, blah, blah, blah. One event that allows the declaration of martial law, and that all disappears. And oh yeah, that's me being optimistic. I think I'm done.
Teresa.
I think this is really obviously going to test our democracy. And one of the people I'm really looking at is Senator Chuck Schumer, because he gained a lot of power last night. And he is really the block, the potential block against all of these things that I and other people fear, because he's will be the Democratic leader in the Senate. And the Senate does not have the Republicans do not have a 60-vote majority. And so the question is, how strong will his leadership be? And that's why I think that the notion of we still have a voice and that voice needs to be heard and to help in any way that we can. You know, I'm just looking for any rays of sunshine that I can find. I don't think there are rays of sunshine, but I do think that there are paths to keep our country, I mean, on the right path. And that's what I'm looking for right now. What are the paths that we take? We are a diverse country. We are not the country that Donald Trump described in this campaign. And what do each of us do to constantly remind ourselves and others that? And who has the levers of power that we can still work with? And I think Chuck Schumer is one of those people.
Mike?
Well, I was going to ask, 8 years ago when Obama was elected, I think Rush Limbaugh and others famously said, our mission is to make his presidency fail.
Right.
Is that what Democrats should do now?
Are you asking me?
Well, there's a murmur in the room. You can start.
Anybody
off
can take that. I mean, I'm
well,
just.
Well, the answer is it depends. I mean, it depends on what he does.
On what he does.
Obviously, as he brings up stuff that is unacceptable. In terms of the American democracy, people will have to stand up to him.
But the Republicans also had the House and the Senate.
It also depends on what some of the other more responsible Republicans in the Congress do and how they stand up to this, because there are not nearly as many, but there are some Republicans that are still there who can join with some of the Democrats to resist anything that maybe way beyond the bounds. So I think that's the kind of, what's the coalition? That's what Senator Kennedy would always ask us in the day after we lost in 94, when he won but the Democrats lost. We had a meeting the next morning. Okay, what's the coalition? What can we do? What can we build on?
Is that a viable option? I mean, is there going to be a coalition of Democrats and Republicans, moderates, if you will, who will band together and sort of become that other force? Because or will the Republican House and the Republican Senate just rubber stamp what Trump does? I mean, that's, I think, a question that will play out and be very interesting
well,
to see.
That's why I'm saying about Chuck Schumer, it really depends on his strength and our voice. Really, it's what we say, Barbara, and what we hold firm and keep reminding people what we are as a country and, you know, what kind of support. And people like Senator Warren, who have such a powerful voice, how she uses her voice. People like Senator Tammy Duckworth, newly elected Senator Tammy Duckworth, yes, a ray of hope in all of this mess. You know, how they use their voice, how we continue to use the leverages that we can build, I think.
I think it's really important. I like what Alan said about talking about how during a certain period, not so long ago, that major movements were pressuring this nation state to change.
Right.
Nothing happened in the federal government. Nothing happened that was not predetermined by the activism of ordinary people fighting. I lived through the civil rights era. I lived through the Vietnam peace movement. I was a part of those movements. I've been a part of most of the major movements for political, social justice since that time. I think that we need to be really smart. I can't wait to hear from my friends who are progressive and on the left about what they think we might be able to do. I think we do have to keep the pressure on. I don't think the solutions are solely within nice people and good people who are in government. I actually know Chuck Schumer because of having held office. I don't know him personally. I've been in his presence and certainly have observed some of the great things that he's done and his great capacities to do, be a really good leader. But that's not the sole solution. We've got to be on the ground with this.
So, Barbara, the next time that a police officer kills an unarmed black man, will there be any recompense at all? In other words,
right now
mm-hmm. you have the feeling that the White House, right now you have the feeling that the White House is putting a little pressure on the Justice Department to make sure that the right stuff gets done. I'm assuming that's not going to happen.
No, it will not happen because we have an Attorney General who actually believes that there is such a thing as police brutality and extrajudicial killings of people of color without cause. She believes that. She knows it to be true. Why? Because she lives it. She's a woman, you know, probably, what, late 50s, early 60s. She lived all through it. So it's not an as told to. She understands that. Giuliani time, as you pointed out when we did the show just last Friday, was the phrase that was used to make a distinction between the Black Dinkins administration and what Giuliani was about. Now we have, on a national level, Giuliani time. It's just, it boggles the mind. It's hard to imagine what all of those issues are going to look like. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was turned over by the Supreme Court. The Congress could put in protections. Have they? No. Will they? Not likely.
Not now.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we have a wonderful audience of listeners who have a lot to say and a lot to ask, and we'll be going to them in just a moment. A reminder, we're expected to hear from Hillary Clinton and her concession speech beginning around 10:30 this morning is the time that we are being given right now. And we will find out much more. We'll return after this short break.
Support for WMT comes from Paradise Copies, Northampton, Massachusetts, providing printing design for customers for over 20 years, from digital to offset, color copies, scans, logos, and more. ParadiseCopies.com. Utica College, working to help solve the college affordability issue with its tuition reset initiative, utica.edu/affordable. And Manchester Designer Outlets, showcasing designer stores with Crabtree and Evelyn, Base Factory Outlet, New Balance, La Crusa, and more in historic Manchester, Vermont. ManchesterDesignerOutlets.com for details.
Welcome back. Thank you very much for being with us. It is our roundtable special, our post-election edition, and I'm Joe Donahue, Teresa Bourgeois, Chris Churchill, Rosemary Armeo, Barbara Smith, Libby Post, Mike Spain, and of course, Alan Shartok. And so I'm now deep in the crowd. And as we mentioned, we're not taking letters this morning. We are instead talking to our audience members, and all I need is your name and then make your point.
Carol Allen from Copake, New York. I was wondering what the new presidency will do about Iraq and Afghanistan. 15 years there.
Foreign policy.
Yeah, the Kellyanne was on television early this morning looking very dapper.
Kellyanne Conway.
And hair, always a sign she's happy. Big smile. And said that the number one priority of the, I'm going to say this, Bush? No, Trump. No,
you can say
Trump
it. Try it again.
Administration. The number one priority would be taking care of the terrorists. So all of the people who voted against Hillary because she was warlike, I think you're going to really see some war now, and that is not good. While we were voting and distracted by all of this, the Russians and the Syrians just bombed the hell out of East Aleppo, and we're not taking any of the refugees, of course.
Secretary of Defense position is one of the ones I'm most intrigued
Flynn.
About.
Jeez, what, General Flynn. We didn't even talk about him.
You
go,
know,
I'm sorry,
who's going to be the Secretary of Defense, I think, raises some really troubling... Well, you know, will the old Republican... You know, it just raises some really troubling questions.
All right, another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Daisy. Hope I don't start crying. You know, one of the things I think we have to be really careful about is... I understand the impulse to want to try to understand the Rust Belt and the economic problems there, but we also can't forget, and I was watching PBS last night, and I was struck by a Republican panelist who concurred with a black member of the panel who's a pollster, who basically, when he saw this was happening, he just said, Trump has given voice to racism in this country. And these people who didn't feel like they could talk out about it before, that's why they came out to vote. And a lot of this was, it was that plain and simple. It wasn't just about jobs. It was, a lot of it was about this. And if we try to make it too much about that and not about the ugliness that he's allowed in this country, that he's given voice to, you know, let's not try to understand this too much in terms of the economic question. I know it's a big thing, but the other is very real.
Daisy, I think you're right, and I think that's what this whole election was about. I think this was an election in which blacks were pitted against white males mostly, but yes, that's what I think happened.
And women, too.
I disagree with that.
I'm surprised.
I think it was all about economics, and we had clues to that all along, including Michigan.
Nope.
We did. And Barack Obama holds some responsibility for this. He spent all of his political capital on health care. What if he had spent it on jobs? What if he had paid attention? Brexit is the same vote that we had. And yes, there is hatred and racism, of course there is. Let's not leave out misogyny, my favorite of them all. But it's easy to do that when you're economically depressed and you want to blame someone else. I keep using the Hitler analogy. That was a time, the 30s was a time of economic dislocation in Germany, and the Jews got blamed. So yes, of course it's there, but it's the economics. It's all about the economics.
But
that's what drives
Rosemary, he did focus on jobs and did bring back jobs and save the auto industry. But I think that...
Not like Obamacare.
Yeah. I think that the economics and race issues and gender issues are all intertwined.
Right.
They're not separate things.
Yeah.
They're all intertwined. And there is an underlying fear among the working class in this country. And what Trump did is pit people against each other. And that's, I guess, wasn't articulate. Well, there's a shared concern in this country about economic insecurity and how people are going to get by. And what Trump did is pit people against each other on that topic. It's all intertwined.
Barbara,
I just need to say,
go to Barbara and then Libby,
okay,
go ahead.
I just need to say, guess who's disproportionately represented in the working class? People of color.
Right.
This thing about... It's the working class. Why don't you just put white in parentheses? Because the thing is, people of color are in the working class. So I really appreciate Daisy's remarks because they concur with the reality that I live in.
I agree with you, but, you know...
Oh, Chris.
I think it is both the racism part and the economic part. I don't think you have to say it's one or the other. But I think if we ignore the fact that the working class is really struggling in this country, we're making a huge mistake.
Yes.
And yes, that includes the black middle class. And if Trump had been a
and
better...
And the Latino middle class.
And the
Latino
Muslim middle
class.
If Trump had been a better man and a better candidate, he would have found a way to kind of unite the black working class with the white working class, and then you'd really have a movement.
But that's how you win in this country.
Exactly.
That's not who he is.
It might be the start of a new Republican Party that you're talking about.
I think what we all have to remember here is that there is a... very large segment of this population who was angry about having a black man in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Trump, when Obama made fun of Trump at one of the press
correspondents' dinner,
that was the beginning of this, because he was not going to be made fun of by that black man, that man who was not born here. That man who has changed things for better for all of us, but not so much for him. And so I think that, yes, race, class, sex, it's all intertwined. But the horrible underbelly of all of this is that this man was endorsed by the KKK and yet still elected, which says something about the anger of white people in this country about having a black man in the White House.
Or the possibility of a woman being elected president.
All right, we're going to go back to audience questions.
My name is Bob. A lot of you have talked about fear. I agree. I think this election was about anger and fear. I would like to know, do you fear that this country might be put under martial law, whether during the next 3 months or after?
I think that police forces are ready for that across the country. We know how militarized they are. You saw what happened after the Boston Marathon. That city, Boston, was shut down in what, a few hours? So their capability is there. I think there is a will there. The language of President-elect Trump, I'm practicing, has given me some fear of that, yes.
You know, there can be martial law without there being martial law.
Right.
I mean, I think that's the point here. Giuliani gets to be attorney general, and he starts to lay out a new system of laws and repression of people. You don't have to call it martial law. It's just going to happen.
When at one of the debates, the individual was asked, what would you do about racial reconciliation? His answer immediately was stop and frisk. Law and order and stop and frisk.
Right.
That was his answer.
That's how he won. You were right before. That's how he won.
And so the
don't forget about the Central Park Five. And
right. Oh, yes. That came out. Yeah, even though they've been exonerated and the actual rapist was found.
Or Hillary Clinton, who he has pledged to appoint a special prosecutor.
Yeah, and put her in jail. We'll see about that.
Yes.
I want Obama to pardon her.
All right. Another question?
My name is Jill, and I'm taking this a lot more personally because I'm thinking that Obamacare is going to be history. Yes. And I think of my brother and my six-year-old niece who will at some point not have health insurance. And in addition to thinking of my brother, who is a black man, what's going to happen when he's walking up the street and gets in trouble? I'm sorry.
Okay. You're all right. You're all right.
Thank you, Jill, and thank you for being open with what's real for people like us. Thank you for being real and vulnerable for everybody to understand what's going on for people like us. There are many tears being shed in the homes of people who you don't know today.
Hi, I'm Piper Lutbach from Saratoga Springs. And along the way of watching this whole campaign go, it seemed to me that Trump just wanted to win. And that's it. Now, he made a lot of enemies along the way, Republicans also. Is this going to affect his presidency? What do you think?
Who wants that one?
I'm not sure I understood the question.
Meaning that...
Can he govern? She's asking, can he govern?
He's not a politician. All he wanted to do was win. Right. Now, politicians make friends along the way. He actually made a lot of enemies. That's how he won. He divided everyone, but he divided Republicans, too.
I think you have a good point, because I think he's a marketer and a showman more than a politician. And
Pence.
To speak to what Mike said earlier, I don't think we know what he believes.
He doesn't know what he believes.
And going back to the Obamacare question, I mean, it wasn't too long ago that he was in favor of single payer. So, you know, who knows what he'll do? It's, if you want to be optimistic about it, you can say, well, the guy who we saw campaigning is not the guy who'll be president, although...
We don't know who that will be.
Right.
And there's no one should ever forget some of the language.
And one of the first
things, you can't just wipe that away.
One of the first things he said that he wants to do is to do, you know, full employment by doing infrastructure repair in the country.
Right. Double what Hillary wanted to spend.
Yeah.
Right.
But of course, when you think about it, back then, 1929,
1930. People didn't think that a certain person meant what he said, and he did.
Mm-hmm. We're pretty close to a break at the top of the hour. We're going to go to news. And I guess I put this to Rosemary because you mentioned it, but you were talking about political capital of Barack Obama. He's been talking for the last 3 months about how this would be ultimately his third term. And so what does this say? You have a president with soaring approval numbers, right, and yet all of that work that he did was for naught.
Yeah,
it didn't work.
His legacy will be erased, potentially in the first week of a Trump administration.
Well, that's what he said, Rosemary.
He's promised it.
But you know, I think if you watched Hillary, I'm sorry, if you watched Barack and you watched his wonderful wife doing their thing, they were trying to transfer their personal popularity to an unpopular person. That was very hard. You can't really do it. And they tried their best to do it, but it didn't really work. It was phenomenal how Michelle would say over and over again, the best, better than Bill, better than, but it rang hollow if you were watching them doing it. I think that was a big part of it.
Particularly with the Comey letter. I mean, all these kinds of things. I thought what you were gonna say, Alan, is that in decades to come, that people will look at the Obama presidency differently, but that would assume that we had a globe that was still habitable. If you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, nuclear codes. We haven't even talked about that.
Right.
He gets
and,
those.
And climate change and that, global warming.
And that really raises the question of, you know, I think that Trump didn't build a coalition, and you need to build a coalition to govern. And he was standing alone right till the end, except for with Ted Nugent. And which is a scary thought. But the question is, what will the Republican Party elders do? And you know, who will he surround himself with? But you know, we're in for some very difficult times. The healthcare question, really, I think, is a really deeply troubling one.
Well, he's on the record as saying that he doesn't want any black men near his money. So he's on the record as having said that.
He wants
just
people
wants
to wear
little men
yarmulkes.
And yarmulkes to do that for him.
Yarmulkes.
Yes, yeah. And the other part of
did he really say that?
Yes, he did.
Yes.
Yes.
He did.
You know,
yes.
We cannot deny also how anti-Semitic.
That's correct.
This
Thank
campaign
you,
has
Thank
been.
Thank you.
All right, we have about, we're going to go over to a news break. We're going to hear the latest from NPR, find out what else is happening in this world. Although, isn't this enough? And we'll come back. We'll have more conversation again. We're expecting to hear from Hillary Clinton around 10:30 this morning. We'll keep you updated on that and probably hear more within the next half hour on that. We're going to come back and take many more of your questions here at the Lyndon Norris Auditorium. We're broadcasting live the WAMC Roundtable Panel. More after this.
This
WAMC Post-Election Roundtable. Very nice to have you with us. We have a wonderful audience here, and we have a lot of questions. Listen to them. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Mike Spain, Barbara Smith, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Teresa Bourgeois. And we are going to go to some audience questions. Back to some audience questions. Again, we are expected to hear from Hillary Clinton somewhere around 10:30 this morning. And I guess the question we heard in that newscast that the president is expected to meet with the president-elect tomorrow, what's that meeting going to be like?
Oh, you want us to actually, that wasn't rhetorical?
It'll be fine. Michelle Obama and Barack Obama have what Trump has not shown us so far, which is grace and graciousness. It will be fine.
And they understand the fundamentals of our democracy, and they respect the fundamentals of our democracy.
Well, those are very nicey-nicey comments from both of you, but I think there's something else here. I think
rat poison in the tea?
But then Mike Pence has to come, too.
Oh.
It'll be awkward. There's no way it's not going to be awkward.
Yeah, it's going to be an awkward conversation. All right.
This is a person who held President Obama's presidency and his right to be president in absolute contempt. That was his springboard to becoming the next president, and holding the first black president in utter contempt. And black graciousness comes at a high price.
Well, you know,
he is so much better than them. Barack Obama and Michelle Obama are so much better than that. And they will show what the dignity of the office is all about. And that's what we have to hang on to.
But as I said, hesitate. It comes at a price. You have to live.
I hesitate to ask this question, but what did you make of his speech last night, of his victory speech? Was there a conciliatory tone?
Yes, there was.
Yes, there was.
Sure there was.
Yeah.
Kellyanne wrote it.
I want to be president. Everybody says the same thing. I want to be president of all the people, and I'm concerned about you. And, you know, that's what he's going
to
do.
He said what he had to say.
Yeah.
He said what they wrote for him.
I keep going back, and I looked at it again last night in the height of my depression at that White House Correspondents' Dinner when Obama triumphant goes, "Oh, yeah, and Donald's here still." And the whole room burst out in laughter at him, and he sat there looking so angry.
Sullen.
And he showed us. Despite everything we have said today, elitist, alarmist as you may take it, I think it's highly accurate, he has done a remarkable thing that must be noted. He has used the rules of the system, stretched them to the absolute limit, played to fear and everything else, but he played the system that's here, and he won. And he's now the president.
And when he walks, Rosemary, into the White House with the Obamas, he's going to say, "Hey, just kidding. I was just kidding."
Right.
You know, that's all part of politics, but now we can be friends.
And
we have a question here.
I was wondering if the panel thinks that the governor is going to then now have a very good reason to try to strengthen the women's rights here in New York State. I mean, he had tried to do it earlier it failed. And I'm just wondering what you think the prospect for that kind of legislation being passed now.
New York State, Andrew Cuomo.
The women's equality agenda, basically?
Yes.
Yeah.
The thing is this. The Republicans are going to maintain their control of the state Senate. And so while they've passed all the other planks, most of the other planks, it's the reproductive rights plank that is the one that keeps getting held up. And so, you know, there were some very tight races on Long Island, Campanin, and one other guy. And you know, there were some seats, I think, that we picked up, but not enough. And so I think Andrew will give lip service to that. And I think that there will be, again, a push by the women's groups for that to happen. But it's going to be up to all of us to make reproductive freedom an absolute priority in the next legislative session. So it means going down, supporting Planned Parenthood, doing what you need to do, because Donald Trump and the Republicans will defund Planned Parenthood. They now have the votes. And so we have to make sure that we do what we need to do locally and in this state to protect it. You know, whenever we had a Republican president and a Democratic governor, I was always happy to come back to New York because I felt sort of safe. I felt safer here. You know, it was sort of, it's a weird thing. But nonetheless, it's this, you know, ephemeral kind of thing. But we have to make sure that we all stand up for women's rights and don't take this for granted. And LGBT rights as well, and rights of people of color. New York has been a beacon, and it can continue to be a beacon, but it's up to us to make sure it happens.
Another, thank you, Libby. Teresa, go ahead.
I also think for the issues, for healthcare, all of these issues, and for the issues, Barbara, mayors are going to be critically important, Democratic mayors, Democratic governors, and then we should all wish good health to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. and you know, really, the Supreme Court is a critical issue, but I think that the firewall here now will have to be Democratic mayors, Democratic governors, and all of us.
And Democratic state legislators.
Democratic state, thank you.
Legislatures. Yeah.
Local elected officials, mm-hmm. you know, all across the board, who can, on the front, I mean, I worked for the city of Boston for several years on urban violence issues, and during the, you know, Bush administration including, and it was very difficult, but leadership has to come from the top, but it all also can come from all around us.
Well, you know, one more. Go ahead, Alan.
Well, yeah, you know that the light was burning in Andrew's apartment last night. I can guarantee you that. And that the governor of New York, and I know you'll boo me for this because it's too early to start on the next time.
He's going to run.
But I'm telling you, I know this guy really well, and I'm telling you that he's thinking that this provides a pathway to the White House.
Exactly. Right.
For him, yeah. That's right. And if people are...
See, they didn't boo you.
What'd you say?
They didn't boo you. No, they agreed with you.
But they didn't boo me because I warned them that they were going to boo me.
And
it was a double, triple fake out. Don't you see? So, in order to do that, his pathway is clear that he has to move from his original stance as a sort of fiscal conservative, you know, a sort of social liberal into a position where he is the people's champion.
That's right.
And he is going to do that because it will suit his purposes to do it. And to answer the question, the women's and the gay agenda are going to be part of that. And he will be the stand-up guy in New York State to do that.
We do have another question over here from the audience.
Hi, I'm Bobby. And this brings up the issue of the media, but it came in a kind of personal way this morning. I woke up, I went to bed with the slightest thread of hope, and I woke up in the morning and put on the Times, and I was totally disgusted because I saw the headline, the part that I could read, and it said that he won as a repudiation of the establishment. And while that may be true, I looked at it and I thought they're still not able to say what it is. It's an affirmation of everything that is repugnant in our society. And I think from the very beginning, even at the end, it was too little, too late. And at the very beginning, they gave credibility to his comments, his words, his campaign. They treated him as if he were a viable candidate. Just because you have the nomination doesn't mean that you embody what the nomination should mean in this country. And that's what I see. It's not just the establishment. It's an affirmation of all that is dark in us. That's all I wanted to say. Media, how the media deals with that. I understand they can't use these words in a way, but there were op-eds, there were ways along, especially in the beginning, where this kind of the flip side of this, instead of trying to fit him into the categories that exist or have existed in the past years, let's say since a candidate like George Wallace, they tried to make him fit into the categories we have instead of being witness to and identifying the categories that no one talks about.
I'd like to hear from Barbara and Rosemary. Barbara.
I think you're absolutely right about that. I have never been able to figure out how he, a multi-millionaire, don't know if he's a billionaire, that somebody as wealthy and as elitist as he is, how he could be a man of the people and not a part of the establishment. I mean, since when? He's a part of the ruling class. Literally now, he's a part of the ruling class. But he was a part of the 1%. And it doesn't really connect except through the path of white supremacy and racism. Right. Then it makes sense.
Well, yeah, trust me. I sound like our new president. He has been covered unlike any other candidate in my memory. And it began with the first whole year of, wow, look at this phenomena. Click on we're making money. We like this guy. So he gets $1 billion of free airtime. And then to make up for it, there's been this extraordinary pile-on through all of the there's not a newspaper in this country. There's one paper that endorsed him. And two, the Wall Street Journal didn't even endorse him. Let's say that. The Atlanta came out. Papers that never endorsed said, no, we can't endorse him. So there was a huge piling on of him. There was also this amassing of investigative reporting power to go after him. There are Pulitzer Prizes are going to come out of this, at least nominations, by looking at his charitable contributions, looking at his businesses, looking at his taxes. This is all work that was extraordinary. And I think there is an argument to say we didn't do that with Clinton. The Clinton Foundation bears looking into, and that did not happen. So that has led to an enforcement of the idea on the right that we're biased against them. The liberal press wanted Hillary, we promoted Hillary, and we didn't. We weren't fair to Trump, and there's something to be said for that. So the press is extremely wounded by what's happened politically. Also, economically, the same economics that led us to this mess, too. So you have fewer reporters. They're completely vilified. No one trusts us anymore. Who is going to stand? Are we going to trust government regulators? I worry about the oversight function, the First Amendment, and the idea of someone opposing and looking over government. I think we're losing it.
What are you going to want to hear from Mike?
I think that, yes, to some degree, the media was complicit. The media abhors a vacuum, so they have to, you know, fill it up with whatever's out there, and Trump was out there a lot. But I think we have to be very, very careful. You know, a free press is the only thing that stands between us and fascism. And Rosemary and I shared an image on Facebook of a guy at a Trump rally. What was it? Noose, tree, journalists, some assembly required. So these people do not want a free press. And I've always been saying, and some people say, no. They want to be told what to think. And a free press is abhorrent to that. And so while we can be angry with the media and we can be dismayed by the amount of ink or airtime that he got, we cannot say it was their fault or that we need to attack the press, because without the press, we will be in a whole world of hurt. What we need to do is subscribe to your local newspaper, okay? You need to strengthen our papers, make sure that there are subscriptions so that they can have vibrant newsrooms and more journalists and more people looking into all of this.
I assume you agree with that, Mike.
Oh, I'd like you all to subscribe to newspapers. But now I just want to say, three-quarters of the public said that they had major problems with Donald Trump. And everything is, I mean, not everything, but pretty much a lot of awful stuff is known about him. We know he's misogynist. We saw the Bush tape, you know, in the bus. We know about his taxes, his tax evasion. We know about the way he treats his employees. We know his racism documented when he was in the real estate business, et cetera. I mean, we know all that. That's all on the record because the press has brought that out. And people, three-quarters of the public agree that he's abhorrent, and yet he won. Something else is going on here. People are enraged, and they were voting for him to express their rage. And that turns to the other side, the Democrats, the moderates, the liberals, everybody else has to look at it and offer a better alternative. And as far as the people that elected Trump, they haven't. And that's hard to realize. It's hard to accept.
I know, Alan, go ahead.
We'll be very quick. I was concerned when I woke up this morning that guys with black suits and earbuds would be outside my door because of my position on Trump. But then I realized it was okay because they all must be lined outside the Daily News and the New York Times, taking care of business first.
Bigger fish to fry, right?
Teresa?
I think just like the country is more diverse, the media is more diverse. And I think that there's a big difference if you read a lot of the newspapers than broadcast TV. And I remember President Obama said, you know, if I just listened to Fox News and Rush Limbaugh, I wouldn't like me either, right? And I think that's an issue and a challenge. But the corner of the media that most concerns me is Breitbart. And I think that that's where we have to, that's, I think, one of the stories that the media missed was the power of Breitbart and social media, that this is this incredibly powerful social media arm, which I believe just basically took over. I don't think that Trump has any core solid issues or agenda, and they came and took over his campaign, essentially. And the emergent power of that alt-right and the Freedom Caucus is, I think, the thing that we have to be most mindful of, and what do we do about that?
I would suggest that people, if they're not already, follow the Southern Poverty Law Center. Mm-hmm. Also contribute to the Southern Poverty Law Center. They'll have more work than ever. Yeah. They are not for profit, so I guess I can say that. But they are the people who track the right wing in this nation and who actually, I think, coined the term alt-right, because they have many, many different permutations of right wing and hate activity in this country. So if we want to follow it and make sure that we know what the latest is, that would be one.
The media has to take some responsibility in this.
Absolutely.
The media just, we totally miss the whole angst on the working class that's been apparent in the world and that Donald Trump, of all people, tapped into, and the alt-right tapped into it. And there's also, look at the voting patterns that are emerging. Did you know there's still an urban-rural rift in our country? Look mm-hmm. at the voting. And we haven't even talked about that in this whole discussion today. Or as I can recall, in any discussion we had on the roundtable over 2 years leading up to this election, and yet that's a really dominant pattern that you see in the voting.
I'm gonna hold you all there. We're gonna take a break, and we're still waiting for Hillary Clinton. We're now told it's gonna be closer to 11 o'clock.
That's
so
good.
she has a hell of a speech to write. So we're going to take a break. We will be back and continue our conversation here on the roundtable, broadcasting live from the Linda on WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We are doing a live panel from the Linda with our all-star panel, and we are waiting for Hillary Clinton to speak a concession speech. Originally, we were expecting it around 9:30, and we're now told it'll be closer to 11 o'clock. So I guess I want to start with this question before we go back to audience questions. And so if you're Hillary Clinton, what do you say? Teresa, do you want to start that?
Thanks, Joe.
You're welcome.
I was actually just thinking about what Chris had said earlier on about Hillary Clinton. And I think we owe her a debt of gratitude for getting into the fray and trying. And I know that might not be a popular thing to say right now, but I think breaking the glass ceiling is, you know, it's much more than that, but that was a piece of it. And she has been in the fight for a long time and has put up with a lot. She's not perfect. None of us is. But what I think, because this is going to sound hokey, because she loves our country and because she does have the long view, I think that she will say something that tries to speak to all of us about uniting the country and at the same time not forgetting who we are as a country. And that's what I hope she says. And that I think we have to figure out what our common concerns are and how we come back together. And I think that she needs to be part of the healing. I mean, this is a difficult time in our country, and I think she needs to be part of the healing.
I know, this is what I love about the panel, because I know who I can go to for an answer that I want.
Okay.
But, and in this case, it's Alan and Rosemary, but
go to Rosemary first.
Can we read into, you're supposed to speak at 9:30 and 11, I mean, can we read into that the psychological of what that means?
You know, I think she made a mistake last night, not making the concession speech last night. Corey Lewandowski, at the, you know, the minute that happened, was it 2 a.m, was on saying, if this were Trump, you'd all be yelling at him. She's not gracious. What does she mean?
He's right, right?
Yeah, he was a little.
Right, yeah.
He was really right.
Yeah.
Not gracious and not a good sign for the Trump administration, but was right about Hillary. I think that this is an extremely difficult speech. I would not want to be making it. This is the end of her political career. As bad as you all feel, imagine what she feels. Remember when Trump said, if I lose, it's going to be a tremendous waste of time and money? Right. Well, guess who it's tremendous waste for? And yet she knows she has to do what Al Gore did, go out there and put on a great face and look hopeful and thank everyone. And that's a really, really tall order. I know she can do it, but if it's taken her a little while to get there. And she has pneumonia, too.
I don't want to say that this was a waste of her time. I really don't. I think what this has done is shown young women that it is possible to reach beyond what we were told is
possible.
Except
she didn't. It's not
but
possible.
But it's still worth trying.
Right.
And that's the message. We always have to try. otherwise.
Boy, I'm not sure I get that message from this. What was worth it about it? She went through hell. She's been, her reputation was ruined. Her husband's reputation was slammed through it. Her entire life was slurred in this fight. And I'm, like you, very glad she did it. I have admired her for years. But I think this was a loss for her, a net loss.
It is. She lost. But I think it's also a message that here's a woman who tried her best to do the right thing, and that's what we need to do, and that young women need to hear that. We do not need to hear what Trump has to say about young women. We need to hear what she has to say.
And one hopes that over time she will be proven to be right on the issues. And I went back, this my white ribbon is for the suffragette movement, and thanks to Pat Fahey, who gave that to me yesterday, but I went back during the night and was reading through the history. And it was a long, slow road, and mm-hmm. we're still on it. And it's a really long, slow, difficult, challenging road, and we're still on it.
Let's go back to audience questions because we love our audience and because they paid money to be here. Hello.
Hi, my name is Mishka, and I have a comment and a question. The comment is, we have learned how important the education system is, and I want to hear what you folks might have to say about that and how that might change. The second is a question. I got some emails from my family that Hitler made sure spread all over the world how humiliated we should feel. And I wonder how that could be dealt with. Who is going to be Secretary of State? And how do we keep his finger off the button?
I'm wondering about what you mean by the importance of education in relationship to this election?
Well, if we look at the demographics that say the educated helped, that the educated were the ones who supported Hillary, what do we say about those uneducated who Trump loves also?
Is that because they're educated? I mean, are you saying that an educated person, look at that both ways. Well, you could say someone who's uneducated is struggling economically more, so therefore they're more likely to be angry, right? I mean, it may not be the fact that they're educated, it may be the fact that they're just not doing, the people who don't have college degrees aren't doing well in this economy.
Absolutely.
You see what I'm saying? I didn't explain that well, but it's kind of a chicken or the egg thing.
I absolutely agree with Chris. That's why I couldn't understand your question, because access to higher education is absolutely connected to generally to class background.
Well,
economic status, more and more and more so.
I also think, though, going back to what you said, there has been a war on education in this country. There has been a war on teaching social studies and civics, or whatever we're going to call it. Right? People don't understand. Somebody asked us to talk about the Electoral College because people really don't understand it. I think that we need to go back to some of the basics of teaching our children what it means to run for office, how law, you know, I remember the after school things of how a bill becomes a law. You know, we need to go back to teaching that. And that has been lost in our elementary and secondary schools. And then we get to the point where people don't understand, and then the economics of all of this come in, and people can't go to college, and the anger boils up, and they don't understand how the whole process works. So they feel like they're on the outside.
And one last comment about that. He will probably close down the Department of Education.
Yeah, I think that you're not seeing an administration sympathetic to student debt. And let's not forget Scott Walker and his attack on this state teachers. University system in his state. That will be embraced at a national level now. So that's scary. I have a son who teaches civics, and he says he has never had the enthusiasm in his classes he has since they've been reading about Trump.
Alan, did you want to add something?
Well, very quickly, I spent 40 years in a classroom. And I have to say that I think we have produced at the State University and other places a very not knowledgeable group of people who understand what these issues are and what the sociology is. And you can see that there is this chasm, there's this split between the people who have been educated in Rosemary's classes and Barbara's classes and in Libby's classes and the people who haven't had that advantage of being able to do that. So one of the things I thought was great about the Hillary platform was to let everybody go to college and to pay and to have no college debt because that would have erased some of that schism.
I think that's a possibility. You know, in Massachusetts, where I live, a very good state, the charter school issue went down.
Good.
Yeah.
But recreational marijuana passed.
Yeah. Yeah. It made it more necessary.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I mention that is people are, really do have their eye on education. In Great Barrington, we have a terrific school system. Terrific. And, of course, somebody came along and said, well, I want a charter school in Great Barrington. And we say, well, yeah, but if you do that, it subtracts from the school budget, and that's not a good thing, and we don't want that. On the other hand, my wonderful education professor wife, Roselle, is always talking about the fact that if the white upper middle class wants to send their kid to a private school as an option, they can do it. But that the kid in a neighborhood, in a really deprived neighborhood, doesn't have that option. So, you know, people waited, and then they said no, which I'm afraid is either racist or not racist.
Let's go back to the audience. I wish we were on television because your boots are really cool. I don't know like what you're expecting to step in, but I good. Oh, you got them in what size? I'm shocked, really. Really. Okay, your question.
So my name is Stacy, and I live in Socrates, and I want to thank Libby for setting up my question so beautifully. In the year 2000, I went to bed thinking that Al Gore was going to be our president, and I woke up and discovered that it was not. I went to bed last night realizing it was very, very close and worried about what I would wake up to learn about, and the nightmare happened again. In 2000, Al Gore won with the popular vote but did not win with the Electoral College. In 2016, the same thing has happened. As I was driving here, I learned that the polls, as they had been tabulated on my way here, the popular vote went to Hillary, the Electoral College went to Trump. My question is, has the Electoral College outlived its usefulness for our democracy? And is there some sort of bias in it that causes us to have these kinds of outcomes? If we can change it, how do we change it?
You know, it depends where you're sitting. This is one of our most popular questions. I'm used to Democrats yelling about the Electoral College for a long time, but not in this election. Because in this election, they thought it was the Electoral College that was going to save Hillary.
That's exactly right. We've had that discussion.
And so, therefore, there wasn't an awful lot of bitching about the Electoral College. The chances, in my opinion, of changing the Electoral College are nil. Right. I don't think it's going to happen. Not with this Congress, not with this group. This is how they...
New York is part of a compact of 18 states now that are moving to change it. It would have to end up with a national constitutional amendment, a federal amendment to the Constitution. That would have to be, go before all the voters, the Women's Rights Amendment did in the 70s and did not pass.
There are easier ways to reform it, too, though. I mean, every state could do what Nebraska and Maine have done,
right,
which is to, give an electoral vote by congressional district, that at least...
Proportionately, they would go to the candidates by how much they got in each state.
Even though it's my candidate got hurt this time, there is a logic to the Electoral College when you look at it. Like, Hillary had more votes, but they're concentrated in big urban cities on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump had the support of that rural population I was just mentioning that spread all through the country. So how do you make for fair representation of that dichotomy? It's a city...
The Electoral College does give people in the those rural states like Wyoming and Montana. It
gives them the voice.
It gives them it overrepresents them though. I mean they have more of a voice than the person who lives in Brooklyn does.
And if you do it by congressional district, let's remember that congressional districts are for a large part gerrymandered.
So that's not good at all.
Let's go to one more question before we go to a break.
I'm Richard. I'm from Niskayuna.
One of Trump's largest promises was he was going to bring jobs back to the United States. And as we know, the widget is being manufactured in China right now by somebody that's probably earning $2 or $3 an hour.
If that.
Mike, how did so many millions of people in the Rust Belt believe that all these jobs are going to come back to the United States like a miracle? I don't understand it.
Anger and desperation.
I don't know if they believed it or if they wanted somebody to pay for the fact that they're gone. You know what I mean? They're not stupid people. They understand. And the truth is that manufacturing jobs have been coming back. But when they come back, they're automated. So there aren't the jobs there that people hope there will be. But, you know, I think they were angry. They're angry that all these manufacturing jobs disappeared and nobody seemed to care. And this guy came along and he was the first one on either side to really voice that, and they responded to it.
We're going to take a quick break. We're late, so we're going to take a break. We'll be right back and continue our conversation. It's the roundtable panel, live from the Linda. You can applaud wildly. We'll be right back after this. Roundtable panel, and to our discussion this morning, again, we're waiting to hear from Hillary Clinton, which is expected to take place any moment now, actually. We're told somewhere close to 11 o'clock. You know, you come back here with me for a second. I know you spoke earlier, and you're very emotional, and I understand that. But you're lost, and that was your question, and I just want to get back to it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. When I was watching the returns, I was noticing that the third party was like 3%, 2%. And there were quite a few states where Hillary only lost by like 1%. Now, I know that you can't guarantee that those third-party votes would go to Hillary, but somebody earlier mentioned about having a three-party system. And my question is, how can a three-party system possibly work when it seems to go against the grain?
Great question. And Rosemary, you were the one who said that.
Yeah, I'm the one who brought it up. I don't know what you mean by
it. Just come a little closer to the mic.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I did bring it up, and I'm not certain what you mean by three-party system goes against the grain. It changes the debate, and the proportions change. And the United States is rather unique among democracies in only having two parties, two viable parties. I think that in this election we saw that both of the established parties did not speak for a large number of the peoples who supposedly belong to them. So everything is all askew, and I think there is more than enough time and reason for us to look at that. That said, I think that the quality of the third-party candidates this year was extraordinarily low. Sorry, all you green and libertarian people, but they were just dreadful candidates. And it does hurt me that, yes, in several states, if Gary Johnson, who I understand may be moving to Massachusetts now.
Not Aleppo?
Not that I have anything to say about his drug use. But he kept Hillary Clinton from winning. So it's not a good system now, but I don't think the two-party system represents the diversity and the breadth of political thought in this country.
Another question.
Hi, I'm Catherine. You know, a lot of the talk has been that Trump won because of the male white vote. I know a lot of educated
women.
Upper
white
middle
women.
Class women that right. voted for Trump.
Exactly. Right.
Where are women at in their heads and hearts that they would vote for a misogynist?
I mean, you saw that in the suburbs of Pennsylvania, Bucks County, Montgomery County, Chester County. I mean, yeah, that's a good point. What happened?
They bought into the Hillary lies trope, and that she's not trustworthy, and that she's not for women. I mean, there was a lot of that went on during the campaign. They also, you know, I don't know what their husbands voted. I mean, look, I go to one of the progressive synagogues here in Albany, and people would come up to me and say, I can't believe there are people here who are going to vote for Trump. And I'm like, yeah, you know, because of race. I mean, I always come back to this. I always come back. People did not want a black man in the White House. It just blew apart their concept of what America is. And I think that's what some of those women, too, They don't care about the misogyny stuff because it doesn't impact them on a daily basis. They're middle class. They have their houses. They might even have good jobs.
Rosemary is holding her hands on her head like it's about to explode.
I mean, look, there are reasons not
to vote. She does that a lot, by the way, but that's another thing.
There are reasons not to vote for Hillary Clinton, and we women need to acknowledge that. She blew off the whole email controversy. She thought she could get away with it. She was stupid to get so involved with the Clinton Foundation. That does look bad. It is a problem of appearance. She went so negative. Weren't there warnings in all the Republican candidates that you don't beat Donald Trump at his own game by going negative? Why wasn't she talking about her wonderful policies on mental health, on equality? She had programs.
She talked about
those all
the time.
And you didn't hear about it.
She talked about it all the time, and it didn't get coverage.
She really didn't.
Not on the stump, though.
She did not. She would say, go to my website or look here. But when Donald Trump, look, Chris Matthews is no defender of either of these candidates, I think. But he said it right. When people listen to Trump, they heard immigration, the wall, they heard war, and they heard trade and jobs. Three clear things. With Hillary, it was, he doesn't have the temperament. I like children. I'm sorry, it just wasn't there. Her messaging was terrible.
I think one of the best explanations I've heard is that when Hillary spoke, she said, I understand why you are angry. And when Trump spoke, he said, I'm angry. Right?
Yeah, so I think, his messaging was just much stronger. I mean, I will start with that New York Times story that came out, 2 years ago about the emails. And it was flawed. It's filled with errors. It was later corrected. We forgot about that. And her team did not answer that for the entire weekend. That stood. And they never came back from it. That's just, I'm sorry, Libby, you know about this. That's politics 101. It was just bad. Mm-hmm. So there are many reasons that women did not support Hillary Clinton. And that is a shame. I take that as something that we need to work on. Millennial young women who do not know what Hillary Clinton has been and has accomplished, who never have been in the workforce, really. They're too young, and they don't get it. And this, you know, the same with the young black people. They did not want to be told, oh, you have to vote for the Democrats because we died to get you the vote. And they don't want to be reminded of what happened in the past. They want to be spoken to in the here and now. And Hillary did not do that.
I just want to not underestimate, as Libby pointed out, the racial animus that at the end of the day, when masses of white people clearly walked into the voting booth all over this country, whatever their class or educational background, they felt motivated around Trump's incredibly bigoted message in politics.
We're going to go to one more question.
I want to say one last thing.
Oh,
that
sure.
Is, well, real quickly, and that is that Barack Obama is one of the most popular men in America right now. Michelle Obama is one of the most popular people in America right now. Hillary Clinton is not. I think and by the way, if Barack Obama was running for a third term, if it was allowed in this country, he would have won a third term. So it really has more to do with the Hillary candidacy. And one other thing I want to say, I'm old enough to remember the ERA. Remember all the ERA in this country? And remember all the women who were opposed to the ERA?
Phyllis Schlafly.
Anita Bryant,
Meshi Rasmussen.
Phyllis Schlafly.
The interesting thing... The issue of millennials, I think, is very interesting, and I was trying to think, too, that they've really grown up in a time when, you know, Newt Gingrich, really, with the Contract America and others, the government's bad, we hate government, government can't really help, and I've tried to talk to a range of people, and over they say, well, it doesn't really matter. You know, they don't understand the relationship between what government does and the effect it has on their lives.
You are so right.
And I really think that this issue of the long-term impact that the people in government who are saying, I hate government, has had on the millennials, and I don't know the voting there. I haven't looked at it yet, but I think that's really telling.
And yet they're enthusiastic about Bernie Sanders, though. So it's not they must. I mean, and he's promising much more government. So
Well, one more listener question.
Hi, my name is Linda from Wappingers Falls, and I got this text from my daughter this morning. When your 11-year-old daughter asks you who won, and then follows up with the question, "Are you scared?" And then on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being really scared, where are you and why? To which my daughter replied, ugh.
Yeah. I mean, that was the ad that Hillary Clinton ran, right? I mean, that's
Ted Kennedy.
Okay. What about Ted Kennedy?
Yeah. I know it sounds Pollyannish, but I really think that, which I learned from him, that there are ebbs and flows in this country, and we have to learn from them, and we have to remember fundamentally what democracy is and what we are as a country, and that the fact that a majority of people did vote for Hillary Clinton says that we are better than this, and that we just have to work harder and louder and stronger and to demonstrate that, and that includes reaching out to those people who did vote for Trump and understanding what their economic anxiety is all about and how we can bring the range of people who have economic anxiety together. And I know it sounds Pollyannish, but I really think that that's, you know, we have to look for the areas of common ground and come together and say no to a lot of the stuff that he was saying.
Real quick, audience question.
Hi, I'm Judith from Saratoga Springs. How much of a pro-Trump vote was this, and how much of it was an anti-Hillary vote? And hearkening back to Michael Spain's comment at the beginning, I think the Democratic Party really does need to do some soul-searching to find a candidate that's less less flawed than Hillary was.
Can I just make a quick little adaptation to that question, because it's something we didn't get into that I wanted to, which is, can we ever believe a poll again? I mean, yeah, we don't.
We never
so,
should. I don't believe.
So you asked that question.
I didn't.
Well, because you were right.
There's one poll that you can believe in, that's voting. That's the one to believe in.
But I mean, to her point of saying, you know, how much will we know if this is an? I mean, there are exit polls, but do we believe those?
Well, all I want to say, somebody brought up before, you know, where did the young people go? The majority of them, I'm looking at a map. The majority, overwhelming majority of 18 to 25-year-olds voted Democratic. And so there is a...
Who voted?
Among those who did vote Democratic. So there is a glimmer of hope, and there is an answer to your daughter's child to say, you're the future.
Right.
Okay, so here's what we're going to do. We're still waiting for Hillary Clinton. We're going to go to a newscast, and if Hillary Clinton starts to speak, we're going to go to that. And it was lovely having you here. If not, we're going to hold, the panel has agreed to stay, and we'll sort of talk up to when she speaks. So with that in mind, we're going to go over and take a break, and we will be back after this. Good morning, and welcome back to the roundtable and to our special panel. We were just joking a minute ago that this is... For the people who are still here, our audience is becoming a hostage situation. They came in at 9 o'clock. We told them they could go home at 10 or at 11. But we're going to hold them over because we're waiting for Hillary Clinton to speak. We are told from NPR that it's imminent and it should be within a few moments. So,
they said 11, but they meant 11 p.m.
Yeah, but maybe. I don't know. That's a good, very good point.
11,
so,
but well, not what time zone, right?
They right. And actually, somebody brought that up as maybe that the reason they waited is because they wanted to do the time zones for California. But whatever the case, we're here and we're with our wonderful panel. Let me introduce them to you once again. We have Alan Chartok, we have Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, Libby Post, Teresa Bourgeois, Barbara Smith, Chris Churchill. Did I miss anybody?
No.
Excellent. Our panel, thank you. So the other question, I mean, we do want to, we talked about this right before the break about polling and what we can make of the polls. And there was something just very stark to me. Alan and I were in the studio last night and we were looking at it and just our heads were shaking because there was that, and again, credit to Alan because he'd been yelling about this for months and weeks, which is... The New York Times would have that, okay, it's 43-45, that's the spread, and that's the popular vote, which actually turned out to be the other way, but then there was, they would say there's an 80%, I think the way we left it as of yesterday morning was an 80% chance that Hillary Clinton would be president, and a 20% chance that Donald Trump would be president, and they showed the line hour by hour, and then by 9:30... By 9:30, those lines intersected, and then and the New York Times had like a tachometer on their site, and it just went, all of a sudden it became 90, 95, almost 100% that he would win.
Not unlike probably what will happen to the market today.
Well,
what's the latest?
What we're hearing is that it's more stable than it was expected to be, and from the very little bits that I've been hearing. So I guess I want to bring it back just for a moment to polling and just how do we get it wrong? I mean, Alan has said this from the very beginning. There's some things you just don't tell your pollster, but really that many people?
Yes. There are some things that you don't tell your pollster. Or, by the way, your mother. You just are going to go out
true.
There. And you, right. You're going to go out there and you're going to vote whatever angst you have. But you know it's not socially acceptable, particularly when, you know, we've been talking about the split between, you know, your college elite, which is what they consider it, and they say, well, I don't want to embarrass myself. I'm not going to. And by the way, when the pollsters call me at home, I don't talk to them. I just don't talk to them. I don't think it's right. But the pollsters get it wrong. I have a theory. Teresa, maybe you can comment on this. But my political science theory is when the Democrats are leading by 2%, forget it. When the Republicans are leading by 2%, that's impressive. Joke. But I do think with some regularity that works out.
I'm not so sure the polls were wrong. We just read them wrong. And when they get close, it's the same with the Brexit vote, is as soon as it gets into that margin of error thing, and it never, we talked on the program, why is it so close? Why is it so small? Yeah. And then when you got to the end, and there was an extraordinary number of people, I think, Barbara, you were one of them, who didn't decide till the last minute who to vote, there was that degree of certainty, and every one of those factors was in Nate Silver's model. The craziness is to look at that fluctuating little tachometer thing, because when you're that close, it doesn't mean anything. And the analogy that he kept using, which is lost on me, but I had it explained to me, was that it was like a place kicker, an NFL place kicker missing a 38-year field goal,
38-yard
field goal, right?
That was the New York Times saying that.
Right, and that is it's not a rare thing. So the pollsters were right, but we imbue into the polls predictive powers that they don't have, that they don't even claim for themselves.
I think the pollsters were wrong a little bit. I don't think they expected as many white voters to come out as did. I mean, they're using percentages based on past elections, and that's where the flaw can be. If people don't regularly vote, and then all of a sudden they show up to vote, the pollsters have trouble capturing that.
They're not a likely voter.
I think we're at an inflection point in this country, a point of there are a lot of confluence of things that are changing, that are our media and how we communicate, you know, how pollsters work, you know, on the phone, how many people still communicate that way. And our demographics are changing, the economics are changing, and I think they all collided in this election. And so I think the polls were, you know, hard to, but the poll that worked for me is talking to a lot of people I know, my friends, my relatives, who were very unsettled. And that's what gave me pause and made me worried about what might happen.
I think this election cycle had more polls than we've ever seen in our lifetime. And we were overpolled, and there was all this data out there. Nobody knew what to make of it because it was all conflicting, and it was just too much.
But they talked about the polls, but not the issues. You know, there was just the if you think about broadcast media, it was all about the polls, but not about the issues.
The horse race, yeah.
Well, again, that's the media that's doing that. It's not
the broadcast media.
Yeah, the broadcasting media. The pollsters are trying to collect data, and they're refining their art, which they have. It's much better than it was, although far from perfect. We are the ones who misuse the polls.
Yeah, but the media, I mean, the pollsters want the media to pay attention to their polls so that they get more polling business.
And
so
then that drives the polling results.
Right, and that's what drives it. I mean, you have ABC and so-and-so, NBC and SurveyMonkey. You know, you have the Washington Post and somebody else. So
That's a really important thing to point out. Polling is a profitable business, but they poll about toothpaste or poll about, a type of bathroom tissue or something like that. But then they
also use the same methodology to poll politically to get their name out there so they can get more business to do where they make their profit. And it's not an exact science. I think Chris is exactly right. There's a lot of factors that they can't factor in. And Teresa points out, I mean, there's just a whole different way we communicate. Yeah. And we don't answer phones even anymore.
And Mike, the one factor that I consider to be missed here is the intensity factor. In other words, how much does that white guy in Michigan who thinks that they've been screwed out of a job, how intense is that feeling? Mm-hmm. And that's tough to measure.
Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, the millennials, did they vote? That's sort of thing I'm interested in seeing. Did they vote?
Well, Kellyanne said this morning that their polling was showing the win. So that's internal polling, though. Mm-hmm. So I wonder what...
I've wondered about that too, because their polling is much more intense and takes in many, many, many more people. They usually have much more accurate data than the public does.
I mean, to Alan's point, I mean, you know, they were canceling things, they were putting people, all those last minute events that they added.
But what then? If they knew, then why were they last minute events? Why weren't they a week ago events or 2 weeks ago? I mean.
Well,
maybe the polls changed quickly at the end, or...
This is what happens in an election.
That somebody told me who is in a position to have direct contact with the campaign in New York City. This is something that she told me a couple of months ago now in September. And she said, I just wish they wouldn't be so complacent. She was talking about the Clinton campaign. I said, they're complacent? I was, like, shocked. And I have thought about that over and over and over again, that they had overconfidence, that... Whatever it was that they were not dealing with.
They had reason to be confident until 11 days before
Thank
the
you
election.
Very much. Right.
And the FBI threw a huge wrench into this, and the polls did reflect that.
They never recovered.
There's no way to know this, but in my opinion, I think she still may have lost had Comey said nothing. I think it was already tightening.
I don't know what you can believe in the polls, but the exit polls yesterday, the early information that came out said that nearly 70%, and it was 68.8% of the people, made up their mind of who they were going to vote for before September, which would indicate that the majority of that was not Comey. And it was coming for a long, long time.
But you don't need a majority. What you need, and what these guys all know, is you need 5% or 6%. That's what wins an election for.
The turning point wasn't Comey. The turning point was the Obamacare rate hike.
That was a killer. Very ill-timed.
What was interesting, I was on the roundtable that day, and we were talking about it, and I don't think any of us realized that it was going to be kind of like the moment that the switch went, but you know, and then Comey, I think the rate hike kind of fed on the economic anxiety that we've been kind of talking about all morning here, and then the Comey thing just you know, reminded everybody of some of the concerns they have about Hillary.
Al Sharpton said that on TV, he had a great comment, a descriptive comment about how Comey fed into the narrative that the Trump campaign had been pushing all along, crooked Hillary, can't trust her, dishonest. What's really happening, the system is rigged. It all came out in Comey, in Comey's letters.
Yeah. We also have a letter of someone who's blaming Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Yeah. Hmm. Again, same thing, you know, that look at what they're saying in private, and it feeds into the crooked Hillary narrative.
Well, this is where the Democratic Party needs to do some internal work and determine who we are.
And also never to communicate in such a way that the Russians can get a hold of Debbie Wasserman Schultz's...
I was just going to say, the one word we haven't said is WikiLeaks. No one's talked
well,
about that.
Well, no, but Rosemary said this Russians very very beginning. And looking at it, I guess I am interested in your thoughts, Rosemary. I mean, do you really think there is a conspiracy theory to be had here?
I don't know, but I know as a reporter that I would start with it. Those margins were very close. We know the states where they were operating. We know that WikiLeaks went into Democratic mailboxes and not into Republican. There's a reason for that. We see the way Putin operates in the Baltic states and in the CIS states around Russia. So it's not out of the realm of possibility. And his efforts have never been to, like, pick one candidate over another, although I do think Trump is to his advantage. But it's just so distrust and confusion. Boy, does that describe us right now.
Destabilize.
Yep.
And I think that is what's so disconcerting, you know, that the, what disturbs me most is and that Trump has no experience, and particularly in foreign affairs. He doesn't know what he doesn't know. And I do think this is a very fragile and frightening time for our democracy, and the global issues are the thing that frightens me most, because he, and this is where I say that I can only hope, we can only hope that the sort of the elders of the Democratic, I mean, the Republican Party in some way step in, and, you know, that's the most troubling to me.
I'm going to ask Sarah, just because we're getting some, do we have any information? Okay. Because there's some chatter that she's actually speaking, so I just wanted to check that we have that. Okay. So while we figure that out,
all the media is just.
She's not in the room yet. Okay, she is not in the room yet, so we're still waiting. I guess it's we're getting ready and maybe getting a 2-minute warning.
So just that I get what's happening here, we're going to wait till she begins, right?
Yes, and then we're going to.
And then we're going to leave.
Right.
Those of us who have to.
Yes, we're going to release. We're going to release our prisoners. If I don't get the chance to do it, whatever the end is. Let me do it now and just thank you all for coming, for being so wonderful and for being such a wonderful audience. Thank you for your support during the fund drive, and thank you for making this such a terrific event and for being all together this morning. Very important, and really want to thank you all very much. Also, we are getting, another part of this is that President Obama is expected to speak soon after. So we'll be taking both of those on the air this morning. So what I'd like to do is take a break, and we'll come back if we can. And if not, I thank you very, very much for being with us. And have a wonderful day. We'll be back tomorrow. For all of you listening, you've been writing us letters, even though I asked you not to. But that's okay. But you've been writing letters, and we'll answer them, and we'll deal with them tomorrow. Thank you all very much. We'll be back after this.
Support for WAMC comes from Lake George Kayak Company, specializing in retail sales on Lake George since 1997 with kayaks, canoes, and stand-up paddleboards. LakeGeorgeKayak.com. Every day is demo day. Gallagher Solar Thermal. Year-round installation, refurbishing, removal, or replacement of domestic hot water systems and solar pool heating systems.